Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. Our first guest this morning joins us over the phone, author and business guru Alice Mann. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here with your guests.
Where are you joining us from, Alice?
I'm in New York right now.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad we found your book first. Our public affairs shows on Tuesday is called This Green Earth, and I think if they had seen your book, they may have snagged it first. One reviewer says, your book breaks down the barrier between profit-driven enterprise and environmental do-gooders. How so?
Well, what I found through my interviews with over 60 business leaders is that there really is a sweet spot where you can drive profit and be commercially successful by also creating products and services that are sustainable. So one popular example that a lot of people know about is Nike's Flyknit shoe and other products that they've created that actually do more with less. Basically, they perform better, but they use less materials and they're more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, you know, you open your book with, I think, a great story. And when people think of electric cars, I think Tesla is the company that comes to mind first today. But that wasn't always the case. Back in 2002, 2003, Toyota introduced the Prius, which was a hybrid car, as most of us know. But tell us the story of that. The story of the Prius actually had begun about a decade earlier as Toyota was trying to increase their fuel efficiency in their cars. So how did a big car company become one of these do-gooders and make a major breakthrough like that?
Yes, I love the story of the Prius because it's actually about long-term strategic thinking. So the chairman of Toyota asked the question in the late 80s, what is the future of automobiles? What's the future of the industry that I'm in? And Toyota at that time was already very successful. So this was really a growth question for him. And what they decided to do because of that question was to invest over $1 billion in the technology, the drivetrain technology that is what hybrids and now electric cars are based on. But it took a number of years and a lot of successes and failures to get to the point that they could put the Prius on the market. And they were really looking at long-term trends like fuel efficiency and the effects of gas on the environment and the what they thought consumers would eventually want to buy. And what they found is when they put the Prius on the market by the second version of it, it became very, very, very popular and actually drove change across the whole industry. So right away, all the other automobile makers wanted to have a hybrid car, and then eventually that led to the electric car market, which is growing now.
Well, we know that fossil fuels and air quality, those are big challenges facing our environment. What are some other big global challenges you see and businesses that are successfully confronting them?
Right. So what I looked at in my book, Future First, was not only climate change, which is an obvious big global challenge that businesses like Tesla are addressing and that's part of their mission to address, but also things like resource scarcity and the way that, for example, apparel uses a lot of water, and water scarcity is one of the issues that will grow over time. And so you see a lot of apparel companies, Eileen Fisher is an example, they're looking at ways to make their products with less water. So cotton, that's the basis of a lot of fabrics and clothing, uses a lot of land and a lot of water. And companies that are thinking far out ahead are thinking, well, these are looming challenges. How do we get out ahead of them so that we can compete in our industry? And then also, how do we collaborate with and create coalitions across our industry to make better products and use less toxic materials and collaborate in ways that don't threaten our competition. So even in apparel, there's been various coalitions to have different supply chain practices and use different types of materials, but those companies can still compete on their product design.
Well, let's talk about these coalitions and this collaborations with other companies. One of the things you say in your book is you think part of the secret is the alliance between global companies and small mission-driven firms. Why is it important to have both?
That's a great question. So a lot of companies, big and small, are thinking about innovation and what are the best ways to innovate. And what you see a lot now is that smaller companies can incubate new ideas and they can test out new products and new services and new technologies very quickly. And then if they're successful, they can either collaborate with bigger companies to scale some of those innovations, or sometimes they're acquired and they become part of the bigger company. And the big companies are really looking to scale, but they're also looking to be agile and have some of the best ideas move quickly across their companies. So more and more, you see that it's not one company, one leader at a time anymore. It's really often a collaboration across different size companies and companies that are at different stages. And also many of the things that we buy now from a consumer's perspective are actually part of, they come from all kinds of different companies working together, whether it's through outsourced, some of the materials being outsourced or part of the supply chain, or we have interlocking systems like Tesla's Powerwall, and you might have SolarCity solar panels, and then you might have an electric car, and all of those work together, but they're coming from different makers that, in the example of Tesla, they've been integrated, but it's not always the case.
We just had a local company here in Park City, Avion Labs. They use Bluetooth technology, and they just announced they're teaming up with Tesla for some Bluetooth technology in Tesla cars. That's exciting to see a local company as an example of what you just talked about. You also talk about big brands like Unilever. They own brands like Dove and Ben & Jerry's. And the Dove campaign that started a few years ago, where they focus on women with average bodies, and they talk about the negative impact of, you know, putting these thick, stick-thin models out there in ads. They hit a bit of a speed bump with that campaign. They quickly recovered. But you mentioned how a campaign like that is not only beneficial to the consumer and resonates with the consumer and gets them to buy the product, but it's also beneficial to the employees as well. And that really stuck with me.
Yeah, well, a lot of research is showing that the millennials and generations of workers now are really looking for a certain amount of, it's not just meaning that they're trying to get out of their work, but they want to know what their brand of the company that they work for stands for. And when you create brands like purpose-driven brands that are owned by Unilever, you give employees a sense, a clear sense of purpose, and also something that goes beyond and touches and reaches customers beyond the transaction of selling the product.
Great. I want to switch gears now. You know, oftentimes folks that write these organizational books have spent their entire careers in academia. I think your background is interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, you have when you first started in the industry, you started off in financial services with an undergraduate degree in history. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes, I'm a liberal arts major who went into finance.
So let's talk a little bit about the vantage point that you bring into this. So you joined. I work in the financial services business as well. You worked for a firm called Hambrick and Quest, which was in the Bay Area. In its day, it was one of the most successful investment bankers. They took companies like Apple and Amazon, or some of the famous clients that they took public. And so you started there for about a decade. What do you think that background, starting as one of the rank and file employees in the financial service industry, gave you from a perspective standpoint that maybe somebody starting in academia might have had a different take on the topic that you're studying here?
Absolutely. So I think that I got very quick sense from Hambrick and Quist during the dot-com era of just how exciting business could be and just how much opportunity there was. Back then, it was through these technology companies to change the world and to have a big impact. And there was a lot of promise in those companies, but we back then didn't know exactly how big that impact was going to be. The other thing is that, you know, this was in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and it was a really, those were fun places to work. Hamburg and Quist was a fun place to work. And then it was bought while I was there by Chase Manhattan Bank, and suddenly I was part of a much bigger global company. And then we went through the Bank One, the J.P. Morgan Chase, and then the Bank One merger. And I learned and got really excited about organizational change and how much you could do and what kind of resources you had working inside of big companies like that. And I didn't expect that. That was a surprise for me. And then after that, I went out, when I went out on my own and I went back to school and I got my graduate degree in organizational psychology, I started working with big nonprofits thinking they were really, you know, they were having an impact on the world and they would be really meaningful places to work. And I also saw the challenges there around having an impact when you don't always have a reliable funding model. And so that got me thinking about, well, how can you combine both, you know, all of the benefits of big companies and the resources that they have and the scale that they have with some of the best of what I got at Hamburg and Quist, which was innovation and through technology, and then what nonprofits do, which is really think about big global problems and how to solve them.
Yeah, you write in your book, and thanks for bringing that up, kind of the not-for-profit world and the challenge with revenue generation. And you write in your book, you call them purpose-driven companies, and I wasn't sure that that meant not-for-profits. But there is a resistance to prioritizing revenue generation and efficient business processes. Do you think that still exists in the not-for-profit world today?
I do. I think that some of it is based on the funding models of nonprofits. They're temporary sometimes. Also, the bigger nonprofits will have a lot of donors and a lot of different agendas to try to manage. And I think that financial model drives some of the competing priorities and sometimes insecurity and also not always having enough resources to really fund, you know, major priorities. But also, I think that just getting nonprofits, and I also did some design work, organization design work in higher education, getting people who are purpose-driven and are mission-driven to also really embrace a business attitude and good business models and practices is sometimes difficult. These end up being polar opposites to people, and that's why the idea of an integrative mindset, I found it brings those two together.
Back to the companies getting bigger and bigger and amassing more power and influence, there was a sci-fi channel show called Incorporated that was on the air a year or two ago, and it was scary. It was like a Monsanto-like company that just had such huge influence on people's lives. But you argue that sometimes that doesn't have to be a bad thing for a company to be that powerful. How so?
Well, I think it is where power resides. I think corporations have some of the largest amount of resources of different institutions today. And so I think it's a neutral thing. It's just, to me, it's just a fact. And so then the question is what they do with that power and what choices there are to make. And my book argues that there are these global problems and challenges that aren't going away, climate change being one of them, resource scarcity, but also a globalized workforce, and that companies that are able to kind of see those things on the horizon and really respond to them and use their weight and their scale to try to solve them will actually be better off from a business perspective because they're thinking long term. And they're managing risks that really aren't going away.
Gosh, it almost sounds like companies are taking on the role of government sometimes.
Well, I would argue that if they can because government operates at a much slower pace, and change in government, because of the nature of government, is just slower, and businesses are trying to move faster and faster, that it's just to their benefit to move faster than government. If they wait for government regulation, for example, with Facebook. If they mm-hmm. wait and they don't respond to the possibility of government regulation, then they're putting themselves at risk, right?
Yeah.
Of having changes that are made for them instead of looking for the opportunity in how they can adapt to what's coming down the pike.
Let me take you back to the subject of not-for-profits and some of these business practices and how both the corporate world and the not-for-profit world has changed as people have figured out kind of these bigger impact ways to conduct themselves. You know, back in the day, you write in your book about John D. Rockefeller and kind of his foundation, and business was business and charitable intent was charitable intent, and never the two should mix. And you talk about some of the early impact investing funds. In fact, Hamburg and Quest went on to do that. Now there's venture capital firms that you talk about in your book, Double Bottom Line. Tell us what impact investing is and how that represents kind of an evolution of charitable groups and their desire to do well.
Sure. So impact investing is a great example of integrative thinking. It's really how can we do well and do good at the same time? And just the idea that you can do both. And that so going back to the Rockefeller example, that early philanthropy was treated as very separate from for-profit corporations. And so you could do one thing with the right hand and something completely different with the left hand. And that was considered, the only model for really doing well and doing good. They were two separate things. And I think impact investing has really used innovation to try to think of different ways that you can invest either in companies or create funds that benefit people in the environment or reduce harm to people in the environment. And those are slightly different things, but there's a lot of work around divesting from things that are from companies and commercial activities that are harmful to the environment and people, and then investing in companies that are able to create products and services that are beneficial to people in the environment. And the thing about impact investing that I think is not obvious from the outside until you get into it a little bit more is that there's different levels of it. So if you're thinking, you know, on the one hand, if you're thinking about donating money to a nonprofit and using your money and there's some tax benefits to that, instead of doing that, you could put money into an impact investment fund that gives you a little bit of a return. And you're also doing something good with your money. Or you can look for, there's also impact investing opportunities that try to get a market rate return, and at the same time, you can feel really good about what you're putting your money into, what you're investing your money in.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, Alice. Your book, Future First, what's the one thing you hope leaders take away from the book?
Well, I'd love people to take away that there are hopeful solutions to a lot of the challenges that we hear a lot about, such as climate change, and that there are business solutions through innovation, and that there are a lot of business leaders who are excited to innovate, and that Tesla is not the only company doing that, and you know that we really need an economy full of Tesla-like companies that look at these challenges as a really exciting opportunity to create something new.
Alice, as Renee said, we've just got a couple minutes left. My last question for you, I'm going to let you choose, actually. Mm-hmm. It's springtime here. Spring's a time of renewal. Our graduates from the local high school here is June 1st. They're going to be heading off to college. And it's also a time of change. And so here are my two questions. You choose which one you want to talk about. We mentioned earlier you have your Bachelor's of Arts in History from Reed. If I'm not mistaken, Reed College is where Steve Jobs famously went. Very, very strong. I've visited the college. Very strong liberal arts, very open-ended. And, you know, there's a big push today for STEM, for kids to take college majors that they know they're going to be able to get a job in day one after graduation. So question number one is just how your liberal arts background has helped you in your career, and maybe your thoughts encouraging kids or not encouraging kids to do the liberal arts route. And the second one is you're very open in your book that you unexpectedly found yourself to be a single mom, which is a very challenge. You ended up getting divorced unexpectedly. And it's a big challenge for folks. And so what advice do you have for people that might be facing being unexpectedly a single parent and facing the challenges ahead of them?
All right. I'll take this more challenging question, which is the second one. And the advice that I'd have is some of the advice in the book about integrative thinking and being able to figure out and innovate, being innovative and thinking of ways to balance all of the roles that you have as a single parent, which is how to be there for your kids and, you know, do the things that are close to your heart and at the same time go out and support your family and do the things that, especially as a woman, that were really a role model for your kids, being able to both be a breadwinner and also a caretaker. And to be able to champion that for other parents and to be able to look at things from the perspective of, for me, it helps me to kind of to find other moms in my situation and to look at, you know, different ways that families can be constructed and that you can think about, you know, vacation and school and even being in part of the workforce, that non-traditional families are actually on the rise, and that it's good to be able to speak about it so that other people in your situation can know that, you know, there are a lot of careers and career paths that are, I think, are built around the traditional family and traditional gender role model, which is that usually it's the male breadwinner has somebody at home to take care of the kids in the house and the family, and that it's really important to be able to reshape career paths so that you can be really successful and also be able to be there for your family and your home.
Well, your children are lucky to have a loving mom who's also extremely skilled, and hopefully the day will come soon where they can read this book. Our guest this morning has been Alice Mann. She is the author of Future First, talking about how companies can leapfrog and take advantage of the future as opposed to being fearful of it. Alice, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.